Mr. Vadas?
Your Honors, in these cases, let's be clear. These are the players who were never indicted, let alone tried, never even arrested. Their claim boils down to the argument that they should never have been investigated at all based on the inconsistent statements of the purported victim. But if police declined to investigate a claim of rape whenever a woman gave inconsistent accounts of what happened, we would set rape investigations back at least 30 years. Back to the days when women's reports of rape were routinely discounted. If plaintiffs prevail, that is exactly what will happen, because police will be discouraged from investigating rape claims whenever there seem to be problems. When a woman claims that she was raped, regardless of her race, her profession, or anything else, police should investigate, particularly where there's medical evidence that corroborates the claim. Now, I'd like to focus on three issues. First, the non-testimonial order that required the plaintiffs to submit to have their DNA samples taken and photographs, and also the governmental immunity and the state constitutional issues. But of course, if the court's not interested in hearing the state issues, I'm happy to talk about other federal issues. Now, the plaintiffs allege that their Fourth Amendment rights were violated by the NTO based on what they claim were false affidavits. They claim that the investigators deliberately included false statements and omitted exculpatory evidence from the affidavit. Now, under the test of Franks v. Delaware, when you have these sorts of allegations, there's a two-prong test. The plaintiffs have to show both that the facts alleged plausibly suggest that the defendants...
Now, let's be fair to what they've alleged. They're saying that Gottlieb and Hyman knew that Mangum had made just 11 different wildly inconsistent statements, and that she made the statements in order to keep custody of her children. She was contradicted by the dancer Pittman, who said the whole story was a crock. That this was simply an uncorroborated, wildly inconsistent, account that many other officers of the force said, you know, had nothing to it. And they're saying that Gottlieb and Hyman knew every bit of this when they applied for the non-testimonial order. What do you say with respect to that?
Well, I think this court's holdings in cases like Torchinsky make it clear that just because a victim's statements are inconsistent doesn't mean that the police should not continue investigating. The whole purpose of an NTO is to gather evidence to see if the alleged victim's account can be corroborated. And that's what happened here. The NTO was sought only a few days, I think it was 10 days after the claims were first made. This was still in the early stages. There's no allegation that police had any reason to know that Ms. Mangum might be making up this claim to save her children. There's no allegation that they had any reason to know that Nurse Levesey might not have been qualified or might not have been telling the truth when she told them that there was medical evidence corroborating the claims. In fact, in the Carrington case...
Here we have another allegation of conspiracy, except this time it's not between the police and prosecution. It's between Gottlieb and Hyman and the nurse, Levesey.
So Correct, Your Honor.
We have two conspiracy.
In these complaints, there are far more conspiracies alleged between the police, the prosecutor, the city government, Duke University, officials at Duke University, the hospital. There are multiple conspiracies alleged here. With regard to Nurse Levesey, there are conclusory claims of conspiracy alleged, but the facts alleged in the complaints are diametrically opposed to that notion. In the Carrington case, for instance, there are explicit statements that Nurse Levesey misled the investigators, that had she not done so, the investigation never would have proceeded. These are not claims that I'm making up. These are explicitly in the complaint themselves. So not only are there not factual allegations to corroborate the conclusory assertions of conspiracy with Nurse Levacy. The facts alleged completely contradict that claim.
I thought we were going to look at the NTO and apply the Franks analysis to it.
Yes, Your Honor. I just answered the questions asked, but I'm happy to turn to that.
All right, let's
again, plaintiffs have to meet both prongs of that test. If they fail either one, their claim does not succeed. And I'll turn to the second prong first, if I may. That prong says you take out all the alleged false statements and you put in whatever exculpatory evidence allegedly was omitted, and you see whether that corrected affidavit still establishes probable cause. Here, it clearly does so. You take out the statements about the broomstick. You take out statements about fingernails being found at the scene, use of aliases, whether they concealed their team affiliation. And you put in statements about how the photo arrays might have been suggestive, or that in the first one, Ms. Mangum did not identify the attackers. You put all that kind of stuff in.
Right.
You still have probable cause. You still have a victim who is saying repeatedly that she had been raped. And you have Nurse Levacy providing corroborating medical evidence.
Well, let's leave Nurse Levacy out, too, for a moment, because at least one of these groups of people has problems with her. And so does that make a difference? Is Nurse Levacy's the two sentences that talk about her in the NTO, are they critical to the validity of the NTO?
The statements of a victim are more than enough to establish probable cause, and we cite the cases in our brief. I think that's clear. I think having Nurse Levacy's corroborating medical evidence makes the case all the stronger, but it's certainly not necessary. Even if you took that out, you would have repeated claims by a rape victim. And again, what we're talking about here is not an arrest warrant. It's not an indictment. We're talking about whether police were justified in seeking an NTO so that they could get DNA samples and determine, is there corroborating evidence or not? If there's not, what decisions do we make on that? This is really a routine investigatory step, and basing it on a victim's allegations is something that police are entitled to do. And again, as this court said in Coakley, affidavits normally are drafted by non-lawyers in the midst and haste of a criminal investigation. An affiant cannot be expected to include in an affidavit every piece of information gathered in the course of an investigation.
As I remember the law, you're not required in your affidavit of probable cause to put in contrary information.
Correct. And I think Coakley, again, says that you're not required to put in exculpatory or contradictory evidence. I think it's worth pointing out, too, that this affidavit, of course, it was signed by Judge Stevens. It was also presented by a prosecutor, Sachs. So you've got his independent eyes on this. There's no allegation that he was involved in a conspiracy or that he was misled. And this is well before Nifon got involved in the case. So I think that under prong two of the Franks test, it's clearly not met. And I think under prong one, it's also not met. None of these allegations that police clearly knew that the team was not hiding its team affiliation because there were banners in the house saying Duke Lacrosse. That hardly suggests that the police were lying when they talked about the team affiliation being hidden. That police knew that aliases were not used.
So is your overall point here that if we let the constitutional claims go forward, that we are doing two things, that somehow we are discouraging legitimate investigations of rape which are reported by victims and were, you know, with some degree of detail, and we ought to be, in this case, the application of the non-testimonial order was made to a state court judge. And you don't want to discourage. The Supreme Court's made the point time and time again, and Leon and many other cases, that you don't want to discourage resort to the warrant process. In this situation, the Coakley and the Franks case were made in the context of an exclusionary rule, were they not, in a criminal prosecution. And one would think, well, how much more are you going to be discouraged from getting warrants if they're going to be picked apart in later litigation for civil damage awards? So you really, to hold people personally liable for, quote, defamatory or stigma plus statements made in a warrant application, and for seeking investigation. We're not just talking here about in the context of Franks. We're not just talking here in the context of Coakley, which is whether the fruits of the seizure pursuant to the warrant ought to be tossed out. We're talking about now looking at warrant applications and stringing up people for monetary damages for resort to the warrant process. And that's a quantum leap forward from Franks and from Coakley. And at the very least, when you're talking about qualified immunity, you say, well, before someone is hit for damages, they ought to be put on notice. And wouldn't be clear to me as a police officer when I made a warrant application that I was on notice that any time somebody claimed I'd made a false statement or an unfavorable statement to a criminal defendant, which would happen all the time, then that's the purpose of a warrant, to get the search warrant to execute it. So by nature, it's going to be unfavorable statements, by the very nature. And they're going to be held for civil damages?
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think that will result in the very sort of deterrence that I mentioned, that you mentioned, that if investigators are hit with civil liability or just the threat of civil liability and the burden of litigation merely because they took an investigatory step that doesn't even involve a search warrant, involves even the lesser animal of an NTO, to have photos taken and to have cheek swabs done for DNA samples. If that sort of thing is discouraged.
They certainly weren't on notice that they were going to be brought into court for monetary damages as a result of a warrant application.
Absolutely not. No reasonable officer could know that he would be subject to a constitutional claim based on the conduct here. Submitting an affidavit in support of an NTO where a victim has repeatedly said she had been raped and where there was corroborating medical evidence. There are no cases that suggest that in that case a reasonable officer would suspect or think that he would be subject to a constitutional claim. If I could talk about the governmental immunity just for a moment. Despite this court's reluctance, I think, to get into the state issues, I think the governmental immunity issue is so clear that the court should decide it. There is no genuine issue of material fact. The insurance policies are the insurance policies. They specifically say that the city is not waiving its governmental immunity.
Could the North Carolina courts handle that with dispatch?
They certainly could, had plaintiffs chosen to file in state court. But I think this, because it's so clear, I think this court can act with equal dispatch, greater dispatch at this point, since the case is before you. And similarly, I think on the constitutional issue, again, plaintiffs put all of their eggs in the Craig basket. But Craig was a very limited decision that said, if a city has governmental immunity and that bars a plaintiff from even getting into the courthouse, then plaintiffs can bring a state constitutional claim in the alternative. But there's a long-standing line of cases before and after Craig which have said that if a plaintiff has an adequate alternate remedy against the same defendant, the city, or against other defendants, then that would preclude bringing a constitutional claim.
I hear you, but I'm somewhat hesitant in a case where the allegations are as serious as they are here with respect to witness tampering and falsification of DNA report, I'm somewhat reluctant to shut it off entirely. I think it should receive an airing somewhere in some forum. And because there may have been malfeasance of a very serious sort, and I don't know, but the federal claims seem to me to be very peripheral in many instances and covered by qualified immunity, but some of the state claims, you know, if something has gone seriously wrong, I don't want to shut down the legal system. And you say, oh, it's all cut and dried. Well, that's less clear to me in connection with some of the state claims.
Your Honor, I take your point. There may be one impediment, I think, in the Carrington case, in that they've asserted diversity jurisdiction. McFadden, I don't think so, but I could be wrong. So that might leave the plaintiffs in the federal courthouse. And the other issue is I think it's important to recognize that this case is about various sorts of immunities. And the whole point of immunity is to prevent a city or individual government officials.
North Carolina is in control of the scope of its immunities. And they can, you know, strike this balance between how far they want these kind of claims to go. I mean, federal courts have a lot to say about the scope of federal immunities, but state immunities, they don't always coincide with federal immunities. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But anyway, let's hear from the other side.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Bob Ekstrand. I am here on behalf...
Who are you representing, sir?
Thank you. I'm here on behalf of the McFadden plaintiffs. That's Ryan McFadden, Matt Wilson, and Breck Archer. And I could tell already that the panel has studied the differences between the two cases. And there are meaningful differences with respect to these issues that are before you. But there are a lot of similarities, too. I have heard the panel clearly express a concern about this being a 1983 case and whether that's the proper forum or mechanism for adjudicating these facts. And I would just simply suggest to the court what the district court said in this case. Judge Beatty, the chief judge of the Middle District, said that the counts at issue before you, counts 1, 2, and 5, set out allegations of significant abuses of power. Indeed, the intentional or reckless use of false or misleading evidence before a magistrate judge to obtain a warrant and effect a search and seizure is exactly the type of unreasonable search and seizure the federal Fourth Amendment protects against.
With respect to the search and seizure here, there's an email that Mr. McFadden authored?
That has to do with the second count, the search of his room. Yes, sir.
But how could they... The email, I think we would all agree, is just unbelievably demeaning.
Well, Your Honor, there's something that I think we all learned a little bit about here. What we know to be true is that the email, in the sense that it's demeaning, is a parody of a book.
How did the officers know it was a parody? I mean, the problem is we've had a lot of very serious, we've had a lot of very serious incidents on college campuses. People acting quite irrationally, and here there seem to be some kind of this person seemed to have some kind of I'm not going to even repeat the language of this email, but he had an intent to kill these people. It was expressed in the email. Now, whether it was funny or what, it doesn't strike me as funny. I can't imagine it would strike police officers as funny. And it was signed 41, which was his jersey number, and it had his dorm room. And so, again, I guess they go and get a warrant with respect to that. But suppose they had just let an email that was this appalling just lie around on the end. Oh, we didn't think it was serious. We were sure it was a parody.
No, Your Honor, that's not our argument. That's not what we're saying here at all. What we're saying is that as the affidavit itself shows, the affidavit supporting the search warrant shows that was a text given to a police officer and given to another police officer anonymously. In other words, there was no indication in the warrant of where they got it from. And yeah, the
but
point
there
is
an indication of the warrant about that's why your analogy to anonymous tips doesn't work, because we know who is doing the talking because of the 21. Sent from his
41.
Email. 41,
well, Your
whatever.
Honor, no,
you
it's,
can tell
it's,
I'm not a fan of any sport.
Right. What the source of the information is unknown to the police officer,
okay.
And this is coming at a time where this entire town is erupting, and
if
it is.
We could just
yes,
step
sir.
Back a minute, because this email was attached to the NTO information.
Well, no, the text was included within it. It wasn't an attached email.
Okay,
if that,
I beg your pardon. All of the information that mm-hmm. is in the NTO request is put in the search warrant request, correct?
Yes, I believe we have
okay.
that attached.
So that we have all of this information, and you're saying that this doesn't, the NTO information, because we're stepping back here a minute.
Yes, yes.
The
yes.
NTO information does not give you, does not pass Frank's second part. Is that correct?
Yes.
So we then we would take out that information that you say is false,
mm-hmm.
and we would put in information that an omission of it would be critical, and that's that Magnin
yes, yes.
did not, failed to identify these people.
She
okay?
could not recognize
them. So then we're left with the rest of this information. There are only four things that we're taking out, right?
No, Your Honor, that's what I think.
All right, well, maybe you can turn
sure.
to the NTO request and tell me what you think, under your argument, we would be taking out, we'd be required under Frank's to take out of it.
Yes, ma'am. Your Honor, we devote about 12 pages in our brief to each and every section.
What I'm really interested in is what you plead. Right?
Well,
that's what we look at. We're looking to see if the pleading withstands a motion to dismiss.
Sure. And I'm
not whether your argument is, but what your pleading is. So what do you plead should have been taken out of this affidavit or this NTO statement?
Okay, well, beginning.
I have something. Can you tell us where it is in the joint appendix? I have 57. Is that the JA reference? I think it's in here multiple times, probably.
If you would turn to probably JA 696.
Okay. I have the document, so my colleagues might want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Facts that establish probable cause, Roman 3,
mm-hmm.
right? All right. So what statements had to be taken out under Franks?
Okay. Beginning with on 314.06. At 1:22 a.m.?
Yeah.
Okay, it says that officers were called to a Kroger on Hillsborough, the victim.
That's true, right?
Because
that's not taken out.
No, that's...
I'm asking you to what, under
sure.
what, your you argument under Franks, what do we take out of this affidavit? It's
okay.
false.
Start with this. The victim, a 27-year-old black female, reported to the officers that she had been raped. That's
right.
false.
No, it's not false. Judge Gregory's just gone through a whole bunch of questions. She did at one point say she was raped.
She did not. She did not say that she was raped at the Kroger, and she did not make the call to the Kroger. Her cohort did to get her out of the car, and a security guard was there, and she was asked Could that woman in your
look,
in your
estimate, but you're not. It doesn't say. It's read what it says, not which the gloss you're putting on it.
Okay.
At 122, Durham City police officers were called to the Kroger.
Sure.
Is that wrong?
No.
No. Okay. The victim, a 27-year-old black female, reported to the officer she'd been raped and sexually assaulted at 6:10, whatever. Is that, you're saying that's not correct?
She did not say that she was raped, and she did not say 610 North Buchanan.
Okay.
What we alleged,
that's what you're, and you have pled that in your complaint.
Here's the thing. From the perspective of a magistrate, Your Honor, I would expect a police officer to tell me the truth. And the truth was that they responded to a call by Kim Pittman to get this woman out of her car because she was talking crazy, refusing to, and this is Kim Pittman's words, talking crazy.
If you had just been raped, many rape victims are confused and they're traumatized. Let me just go, what they did know was that, you know, this was an eyewitness, and the victim claimed rape. Rape victims can be traumatized and confused. They knew a party had been held at an address certain. They knew a lacrosse team had been at the party. They needed to gather evidence to find out who. And, okay, a lot of it now, I understand all the points about Pittman and the wildly inconsistent statements. But,
and the fingernails. Those go out.
But at the same time, if under circumstances like this, you might throw out the evidence, but if you subject officers investigating a rape of this sort to civil liability for things that are in a warrant application, you have to ask whether you're doing in a hard and difficult case something that can really cripple the investigative functions and that can discourage resort to the warrant process. I just keep coming back again and again to the point that Frank and Coakley were in the context of an exclusionary rule. They weren't doing this in the context of civil liability, and how can we deny someone qualified immunity when we take a step and a leap that's this significant?
Yes. Your Honor, just to, and my time is up, that's an important question I'd like to answer if I could. First of all, the question is an important one that I think the Supreme Court has repeatedly spoken to, and it's not obvious. But the answer, I think, as the Supreme Court has said, is that we want to foster 1983 claims so that we can clarify the law of our Constitution, especially when it comes to police interactions with the public and with police interactions with prosecutors. But this court has held that civil liability attaches to a fabricated search warrant in Miller versus Prince George's County. And the real question for qualified immunity purposes isn't whether the officer knows he could be sued. The question is whether it was clearly established that the officer was engaging in conduct that violated the Constitution, period. And so for whatever purpose that fact is later used, be it exclusionary rule or a 1983 action, the question is still the same. Did the officer have notice by this court's precedents or the Supreme Court's precedents that their conduct was violating a clearly established constitutional principle? And here we're alleging that a fabricated affidavit to obtain a search warrant to seize and search all three plaintiffs was clearly established as a violation of the Fourth Amendment. My time is up.
Can I just ask you,
yes, ma'am.
I just want to know where we go. Don't we, let me ask it this way. Don't we look at your complaint to see what it is that you are saying is fabricated?
We look at it for two things. And in this case, many cases focus on the fabrication. And for example, the case of the city sites, I think it's Unum, has two fabrications and no omissions. We have alleged, and we spent a lot of time in the complaint alleging facts that were known to the police officers that are relevant.
But don't you have to tell us in your complaint what you think the basis is for your Frank's claim?
Yes.
And you have to say as much. These are the things that were false in the NTO, and these are the things that were omitted in the NTO. And so we can look, we can rely on what you've said in your complaint.
Yes, and I think that we've alleged at least 14 omissions and, you know, 15 omissions. I mean, there are probably enough omissions in the 15th alone, all the observations.
Okay, you and I are also on the same page that you don't have to put Supreme Court laws, you don't have to put exculpatory evidence into your affidavit.
Well, you have, the rule is that the Franks analysis, and this court has adopted the omissions dimension, right, is that all factual, all false statements need to be stricken, and all material omissions need to be imported.
Right.
And so
that's the standard.
Yes.
Okay, we are on the same page. And finally, you don't make a Malley claim, do you?
Can you? I plead ignorance. I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to.
The only time you cite Malley is with respect to immunity. I don't think you do. That's fine. I think you're done.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Mr. Patterson.
May it please the court, Pete Patterson on behalf of the Carrington plaintiffs. I'll pick up where we left off here on the Fourth Amendment claim. And just a couple of points I wanted to make on that. One, in terms of the victim's statements, the alleged victim's statements. The evidence you have in this case, or the allegations that they weren't reliable, that they didn't amount to probable cause, is that the officers themselves who were initially assigned to the case didn't believe that they amounted to probable cause. The allegations are that the claims were going to be dropped. She wasn't believed. She had recanted three times. And it wasn't until Gottlieb got the case that it was even going to move forward. So that's, you know, much different than other cases cited by Durham, where there was other corroborating evidence, reasons to think that the witness was telling the truth.
With respect to the Carrington complaint, I think one of the arguments you need to make answer is that the complaint in its own terms suggests that the nurse, Levesey, misled the officers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so you have, to put the defendant's position is, you have the combination of a victim claiming a rape of some sort, plus medical testimony by Levesey that there were signs consistent with sexual assault. Then you have additional, the large number of people who may have done it, and we know now none of it occurred, but I mean, I'm just trying to, you understand, we're trying to put ourselves back in time. Right. We know now that none of these allegations panned out, and that's clear, but we're trying to put ourselves back in time. If you stand from the standpoint of the investigation of dealing with a rape victim, it would be highly inappropriate for male police officers to be undertaking any sort of intimate examination. So they were perforce reliant on the female nurse who conducted the examination. And then the complaint says that we have conspiracy, but here there are certain statements in the complaint that seem to dispel the suggestion of a conspiracy, and it claims that we were this is the Joint Appendix 517, Levesey embellished her misrepresentation, falsely assuring Sergeant Gottlieb about the results of the examination, and that an allegation that gave the spirit that Nurse Levesey said, if the Durham police had been advised truthfully by Levesey that the physical and medical evidence was inconsistent with multiple changing, with Mangum's multiple ever-changing conflicting stories, then the investigation would not have been revived and pursued. So it's not just one statement. There are a number of them that indicate that they were misled, but not far from being in conspiracy, they were misled.
Well, we explicitly, as you acknowledge, allege that there was a conspiracy and that Gottlieb and Hyman knew she was not telling the truth. And the statements that she was, that the investigation would not have continued if she would not have done that, the reason that's the case is that Gottlieb and Hyman wouldn't have had anything to work with had she not worked with them to come up with those misrepresentations. And the other allegations that make that at least plausible, which is all that we need to find here, is that we have alleged that throughout the course of the investigation, she worked with Gottlieb and Hyman to tailor her testimony to what was needed to overcome the overwhelming exculpatory evidence that continued to build. So we have not alleged that Gottlieb and Hyman were misled. We have alleged that Levesey was lying, but we allege that they knew that she was lying and they were working with her. And in terms of what the her allegations, the other point I wanted to make was the other officers, who included two female police officers, were going to let the case not go forward. That was even before that point that they knew that that Pittman had said all the charges were a crock. So even before that statement came in, the officers did not give any credit to Mangum's allegations. And there's also been some concern that these federal claims are somewhat peripheral in this case, but I would submit that this Fourth Amendment claim is actually central, because the NTO is what kicked off the media frenzy. The issuance of the NTO is what drew the press attention to this case in the first instance. And while my clients were not actually indicted, they suffered through intense media scrutiny, harassment, and threats. Their lives and their reputations continue to be stained because while the allegations were front page news, you know, the retractions often do not garner the same sort of media attention. So they continue to be stained by these
allegations. Yeah, the great many of the allegations that are made with respect to the various actors in this whole business relate to acts and things that were taken that were post NTO conduct.
Well, the in terms of the NTO, the only post NTO conduct I think that we've pointed to is
March
the continuing
29th meeting was a post NTO meeting, was it not?
Yes, and we've referenced
the special
that
prosecutor's investigation is all post NTO.
Yes,
and all of his findings.
Right. And we haven't relied on that for our NTO claim. The false affidavit claim, that what we've relied on is the continuing course of conduct with Nurse Levesey that shows that from the beginning they were working with Nurse Levesey.
But
I think
all
in terms
of people are dragged in, and the meeting with Baker,
right,
and Chalmers and mm-hmm. Hodge and Russ mm-hmm. and Counsel and Lamb and whoever.
Yes, and our supervisory liability claim.
But that was March 29th, and when was the affidavit submitted?
That was March 23rd. So in terms of the supervisory liability claim, we have pointed to, again, a course of conduct to which supports a plausible inference that these supervisors were acting with deliberate indifference from the beginning. And we've pointed to pre-NTO conduct in the terms that they knew that Gottlieb had a history of abusive tactics toward Duke students, that he had in fact been assigned away from the neighborhood around Duke University because of that, that this investigation should have gone to the violent crimes unit, not to Gottlieb, who was dealt with property crimes.
The appellants have responded to the point you just made by indicating that you don't particularize any arrests or searches that he made without probable cause or where the evidence was thrown out.
We don't refer to any particular arrest. We refer to statistical evidence that is similar to the evidence this court considered in Shaw about a disparate number of his arrests that concerned Duke students. We point to allegations that his tactics had included false arrests and the types of things that had occurred here. I did want to make one other point also with respect to the Stigma Plus claim, which is also in this case, and that is that the cases from the other circuits that they cite do not actually hold that the Fourth Amendment cannot form the plus in a Stigma Plus claim. It was not adequately connected to it, or there simply wasn't a Fourth Amendment issue in the case. The Fifth and the Ninth Circuits, the two circuits that have squarely addressed it, have held that the Fourth Amendment can form the plus, and not only that, that it was clearly established by Paul versus Davis.
I'm not sure about that. And once again, I think the greatest hurdle you have to face on this is Paul v. Davis, with respect to having the due process clause undergird what essentially are defamation claims, and that Supreme Court makes the point that this is just not a good use of the due process clause, and we don't want that.
Well, if you look at Paul v. Davis, that case, they addressed a law created by state law, and they said if there's a defamation in connection with that, then a cause of action can lie. And then in footnote 5 of that case, which I would urge you to look at, the court said, of course, the 14th Amendment protects rights other than rights, liberty and property interests other than rights protected by state law, including the rights protected by the Bill of Rights.
Would a public information officer who never named any individual plaintiffs in the statements that are cited to me be brought up on a due process Stigma Plus claim?
Under Paul v. Davis, it's clearly established that stigma in connection with
Paul v. Davis, if anything, was clearly established. It's just the opposite, which is that the due process clause, we're not going to bring this to a constitutional level. And I say, if we bought off on what you said, I honestly think we'd be overturning a section of the Federal Tort Claims Act. Look up 2630 or what it is. The statute's explicit. It says this statute does not apply claims brought in defamation and the like. And of course, a due process clause, if we accepted your position, would override the statute. And so would we be saying that that statutory exception was null and void?
No, but you'd be saying when it's in connection with a violation of the Bill of Rights that it can be brought. And I just urge the court again to look at footnote 5 of the Paul v. Davis case and then the Marrero and the Cooper cases from the Fifth and the Ninth Circuits.
Do you have anything further?
I have nothing further, so, unless there are other questions.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Your Honors, I will be extremely brief. Counsel said that they do not allege in the complaint that Nurse Levacy misled the investigators. In fact, they say so explicitly. Paragraph 7.
One of them says it, one of them doesn't.
I think the one of them says
one
it explicitly.
Does,
and I think in McFadden it's implicit at least. But it's clearly explicit. I'll just refer you to paragraph 7, 8, and 211 of the Carrington complaint. Regarding Stigma Plus, I will just read from Paul v. Davis very briefly. The court said, if respondents' view is to prevail, a person arrested by law enforcement officers who announce that they believe such person to be responsible for a particular crime in order to calm the fears of an aroused populace presumably obtains a claim against such officers under Section 1983.
Yeah, I think we've all read that case.
Okay.
More than once.
It is hard to believe that there's any logical stopping place, the court says.
Can I ask you just one question about Frank's argument, which seems to be holding me up but nobody else up? And that is when I questioned one of your colleagues on the other side. He said to me, we have 26 pages or 35 pages or some huge number of pages about things that are false in the NTO papers. What do you have to say about that?
I'd say that those 26 or so pages seem to be in their brief, and they're not alleged in the complaint. And I think we go through that in our reply, that there are really only four statements, I believe, the broomstick, the alias, the team affiliation.
Well, I think their complaint alleges the facts, and then in the, you know, those paragraphs that begin separate counts, they say they're re-alleging. You're familiar as a litigator with those paragraphs that re-allege.
Surely, Your Honor.
What case law says that we don't count them in when we're making the Franks analysis?
Oh, I think you can count anything that's fairly said in their complaint, but I don't think there is anything that can fairly be said to allege that it was left out of the complaint. There are only those specific statements about the broomstick, et cetera. And then they do allege that all of the inconsistencies in Ms. Mangum's statements and those things should have been included. But as this court has heard enough of, there's no obligation to include exculpatory evidence in an affidavit.
Unless we find it's material, it would make a difference.
If it changes one of the facts that's asserted somehow and makes the assertion misleading, then I would grant. But that's not really what's at issue here. They're saying that the photo array should have been said that she didn't identify them in the photo array. That doesn't render anything that was said about the statements misleading, in my view.
Okay.
And finally, we've been racking our brain at table thinking of how this court, if it were so disposed, could get this case into state court. Where diversity is alleged, we can't come up with a way to do that. And so we would say if the court can't find a way, if it's going down that road, we would say that immunity delayed is immunity denied. There are numerous immunities pled by the city defendants here. There's public officer immunity. There's governmental immunity. There's the public duty doctrine, which is essentially a form of immunity. To have this case continue either in district court, federal district court, or in state court is really amounting to a denial of immunity because it is subjecting the officers in this case and the city of Durham to more litigation, more expense, more distraction from their responsibilities. And so we would hope that this court would see fit to grant our motion to dismiss and the motion for summary judgment. And with that, I have nothing further to say, Your Honors.
Thank you. We will adjourn court. We will come down. I'd like to greet all the counsel in connection with all three cases.